Questions? So probably the single most important factoid to remember from this class is that finding the distances to nearby stars, stars in general, is really hard for astronomers to do, and it would be no difficulty, for example, to find people's estimates to the star Betelgeuse that differ by 30% or so. It's really hard to find the distances to stars. For the most nearby stars, to stars that are within 100 parsecs of us, we can use this surveying technique, which is known as parallax. So the idea is that as the Earth goes around in its orbit, the star is going to appear to be next to one star or the other star, and by measuring that apparent change in position, we can get an estimate of the distance. The smaller the apparent change in position, the greater the distance that the star is away. And that's the basis for this unit, which we won't have much use of, but is actually pretty common, called the parsec.
So these reference stars you're talking about, they would have to be quite a bit further away.
They'd have to be much further away. But that's kind of not a problem, because it's only the nearest stars that we can use this method on at all. So if you pick a random star, it's not going to show much parallax. You have to, there are only a relative handful of stars, you know, maybe 100,000 stars, that are close enough that you could even see any shift in position. And the shift in position, even for the nearest stars, is just incredibly tiny. It's not something that I personally would ever try and attempt to measure. So in the online picture we were seeing, it kind of, you saw a picture of a bunch of stars, and you saw a star that moved kind of back and forth, that sort of scale. That's just very much not the case. So if we were to blow up the image of one of these stars as big as we could, there'd be some blurry disk that's caused by atmospheric seeing. And for the most nearby stars, that star would move about one seeing diameter during a year. So it's just very, 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 very difficult to measure. And only people who are really crazy about accuracy could ever come up with doing this. And we had to wait into the mid-1800s before Bessel was able to do it. And along the way, lots of little problems with telescopes were cropped out, right? Telescopes typically bend themselves just when you aim them in different directions by way more than this one arc second. So it's crazy difficult to measure parallax, but there are people who have done it, not including me. And so we do have distances to a good number of stars. Most of these stars that we have distances to are based on this satellite Hipparchos that the Europeans sent up, I don't know, maybe a decade ago now. And there are questions about the accuracy of at least some of those parallaxes. Okay, so for the sun, and so incidentally I've got this comparison of the sun and other stars. You will have no difficulty finding me making the sibboleth occasionally to talk about the nearest star and be excluding the sun, right? The sun really is fairly particular because it's our star, but it is a perfectly good star. It is the closest star to us, but it's really easy to put it in a different category because we're just way closer to it. So there are lots of things that we can do with the sun that we can't do with the other stars. So in particular, we can get really accurate distances to the sun, you know, 6-digit accuracy to the distance to the sun, whereas we can't do anything like that for the other stars. The sun actually shows a sizable disk, right, that's way bigger than the seeing diameter. So you can go back to the Greeks and you can find measurements of the angular size of the sun about half a degree that are reasonably accurate. Not so for the stars. The stars, the actual diameter of a star is way smaller than the seeing disk, right? Typically, a thousandth of the seeing disk would be the actual diameter of the star. So the fuzzy picture we're seeing of a star is hugely fuzzed out, you know, 1,000 times the actual size of the star. So if we want to get the actual diameter of a star, it's pretty tough. So you can get above the atmosphere, but it turns out that even then, the disks of the stars are typically way smaller than the resolution of the telescope. So Hubble Space Telescope can get the actual disk of a handful of stars, including Betelgeuse, which is an absolutely huge star. But generally speaking, directly measuring the size of a star is approximately speaking impossible. So the best bet is to have a distant object slowly, when I say slowly, actually within a second, slowly dim out that star. And by timing how long it takes for, say, the moon to totally cover a star, that's called a lunar occultation, we can get the angular size of stars that happen to be on the path of the moon, right? That's a small percentage of stars that happen to be along the path of the moon. I'll comment that, so for the radius, if we know the angle and we know the distance, then we can just use geometry to calculate the radius of the star. And of course, if we have the distance and we have star also happens to be on the path of the moon, then we can get the radius of that star. Incidentally, the book, this is kind of jumping ahead a little bit, in the section of the book that talks about finding the radius of a star, it talks about using this equation, which is a good equation, and we'll talk a lot about it in the future, but that's basically based on a lot of assumptions. It's not what I would call a direct measurement of the radius of the star. Using that equation, you could go wrong under lots of circumstances. So in terms of direct measurements of the radius of star, we're limited to a handful of stars using, for example, lunar occultations. There are a handful of other methods that also give us some radii of stars. In terms of mass, we talked about Kepler's third law. If we know how far a planet is away, a moon is away from a planet, and we know how long it takes that moon to go around, we can calculate the mass of the thing at the center. So the same thing goes for the planets. If we know how far they are from the sun and how long it takes them to go around, we can calculate the mass of the thing at the center. So we've got, again, very accurate knowledge of the mass of the sun because we know those distances and we know those periods. We can do pretty much the same thing for stars if there happen to be two bright dots to look at. Typically, we can't literally see planets around other stars. We'll talk about how we detect planets around other stars. So typically, it takes a binary star system where we have two bright dots that we can follow over the years and see how long it takes those bright dots to go around each other. But again, we have that same problem. We can see the angular distance between those two stars, but we actually need the physical distance in order to plug into this formula. So to convert angles to actual distances, we're back to using this geometry. So not only do we have to have a binary star system where we can see two dots going around each other, we also have to know the distances to those stars, and that's back to finding the parallax of those stars. Surface temperature for the sun, the spectra of the sun that's over there looks kind of like the usual bell-shaped curve of a black body. And if we just pick out the peak wavelength, which we can do moderately accurately, we'd get a pretty good representation of the temperature of the sun. It turns out that method doesn't work really well for other stars that are either hotter or cooler than the sun. And that's just basically because of all the absorption lines obscuring exactly where that peak occurs. And it turns out that problem is actually a benefit in the sense that because the temperature determines what composites are in the atmosphere of the sun, that is to say, whether the silicon, for example, is in singly ionized form or doubly ionized form or triply ionized form, by seeing which one of those, which set of absorption lines occur in the spectra of the star, we can figure out the temperature to pretty good accuracy. So for the coolest stars, we actually have molecules in the atmosphere of the star. And as we go higher and higher in temperature, we go, for example, from unionized iron to ionized iron. And so we have, here's an example of a molecule that's in the atmosphere of a cool temperature star. This is titanium oxide. Okay, so which ionization states of the elements are in the atmosphere of stars is kind of the best way to figure out the surface temperature of stars. And of course, it goes without saying that it is just the surface temperature is going to be way hotter inside of the sun. Surface composition, we can look at what elements are absorbing and how strong their absorption lines are in order to to estimate the surface composition. And you remember the upshot of that is that pretty much all the stars have the same composition, 75% hydrogen, 25% helium, and a little bit of else. And it's actually the else that varies the most between stars. Some stars might have a few times the amount of else that the sun has. Some stars might have a hundredth the amount of else that the sun has. So the conditions inside of the star, for the sun, we have seismology. We can look at the vibrations of the star. That's pretty difficult currently to use. So currently for most stars, the only way we know what's inside of them is based on that computer calculation based on a knowledge of hydrostatic equilibrium and energy transfer, all those sorts of things we talked about before. How bright a star is, that is to say its light flux, for the sun, we can pretty much measure that directly, how much sunlight is hitting the Earth. We do have a problem of the transparency of the Earth's atmosphere that makes it difficult to do that really accurately. So we really needed to get above the Earth's atmosphere before we could see the pretty small variations in the brightness of the sun, parts per thousand, that come with the presence or absence of sunspots. For the stars, we typically compare them to Vega, and since the starlight of Vega is going through the same atmosphere, if we know how fractionally bright the star we're looking at is compared to Vega, we can calculate its brightness. Right? Vega and the star will have the same effective atmospheric transparency, so maybe half the light gets through from both Vega and the star. We can figure out then what fraction the star is of Vega. And that's the basis for the magnitude system, which we've talked about. Basically, the magnitude system is based on a logarithm measurement, the brightness of the star, and Vega is a pretty bright star, so this is usually a small fraction. So the brightness of the star divided by the brightness of Vega gives you the magnitude of that star. And again, we'll never actually use that equation, but it is in fact how you would calculate it. So we also are interested in the actual power output of the star, right? So a light bulb can seem dim just because it's distant, and the same thing applies to stars. If we know how bright a star is, if we know how many watts per square meter it's producing, and we just calculate how many square meters it would take to surround that star, we can calculate the luminosity of the star, the wattage of the star. And we can use the same technique for other stars as long as we know the distance, which of course, very often we don't. So the upshot of all of this is that typically it takes a variety of kind of unlikely situations. A star has to be close, a star has to be on the path of the moon, a star has to be part of a binary system. There are a variety of requirements in order to get the data that we can always get for the sun, so that we have good data, like the mass, the radius, the temperature, the luminosity, on relatively few nearby stars. And we're going to assume that that's a representative sample, that all stars are pretty much like the stars that are near the sun. And, you know, we could go wrong on that, but it's probably a pretty good guess. Questions? Okay, so there's one topic that kind of don't ask about the sun at all, and that's the velocity. And of course, the reason we don't ask it about the sun is we're usually talking about, if we're talking about velocity, we have to be talking about relative velocity, velocity compared to something else. So the sun obviously has zero speed compared to itself. But we can ask the same question about the stars. How fast are the stars moving compared to the sun? And we want to distinguish a variety of different types of velocity or motion of the stars. It turns out the easiest one to measure is what's called the proper motion. And it's really kind of a funny name because there isn't really anything that's proper about it. What proper motion is referring to is the change in the angular position. So over the centuries, the constellations are gradually changing shape because the stars that make up that constellation have different motions on the celestial sphere. This obviously doesn't make any big changes over your lifetime or even over the millennium, but if you have old photographs, you can measure the very small change in position over long periods of time. And we do have lots of old photographs. So this is a change in the angular position over time. And it's typically a small angle per century for the star's apparent motion. Now, the proper motion obviously depends on the actual speed and the distance. So if something is relatively close by, even if it's moving relatively slowly, it'll have a big proper motion. Whereas if something is very distant, even if it's moving pretty fast, its angle won't change very much per time, right? So if you compare a fly that's buzzing around your eye that's maybe only going 3 miles an hour to watching the cars on I-94 going 70 miles an hour, you know that the fly seems to be moving a lot faster, but you know the cars actually have more miles per hour. So in order to convert this proper motion into actually miles per hour, to actual velocity, we have to know the distance. But even that isn't exactly enough, because the star could be moving right towards us, in which case its angle isn't going to change, or it could be moving right away from us. So technically speaking, if we're measuring proper motion, we're only measuring the velocity that's perpendicular to us, the so-called tangential velocity. So we can get the tangential velocity basically by multiplying the distance times the proper motion. If we want the radial velocity, that's actually easier to get. Because we know if we have a moving source of light or sound, it's going to change the frequencies. That's the Doppler effect. So instead of a particular line occurring at this particular spot, if the star is moving towards us, this particular line will be shifted a little bit to the blue. So we can use the Doppler effect . And of course, if we know how fast it's moving tangentially and we know how fast it's moving in or out, we can combine that to get the actual three-dimensional velocity, which is called the space velocity.
In regard to the radial velocity, how would you know what the fundamental frequency would be if it's always, if the only way you can observe it because stars don't change their direction. They're always moving. If a star is moving towards you.
Pretty much. So there are cases where they're orbiting each other, and we'll talk about that in a second. But for a typical solitary star, over our lifetime, its speed isn't going to change, so it'll have the same Doppler shift.
So how do you know what its color is supposed to be?
Yeah. So let's say we measure the position of one of these lines and that it's at, 4, 1, 2, 3, angstroms. It's some particular position. How do we know that that's a shifted line from 4,122, or whether it's a shifted line from 4,125? Right? How can we tell? And if it were just one line, we would be in trouble. But in fact, we don't have one line. We've got thousands of lines, and we know what to look for first is going to be the hydrogen line, because that's what things are mostly made out of. And so by finding something that matches not just one line, but matches hundreds of lines, then we can have a good idea of the speed that it's going. And realistically speaking, these are the prominent lines in the sun's atmosphere. And you can usually make a very good guess. It's pretty rare that there's a lot of ambiguity, that there may be something that has just the same size energy jump as, say, oxygen, but then chances are it's a pretty rare element, so it's unlikely you would see it in any case. But there are a handful of cases where there are relatively common things that have very similar energy jumps, and you might run into a problem. But that's relatively rare, and usually you have hundreds of lines to work with. And occasionally people have made mistakes. They've thought that this was a line of X and it was in fact a line of Y, so they got the velocity wrong. But that usually only happens with things that are moving very, very, very fast and are therefore very, 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 very far away. And so we're, you know, really not sure of what's going on there at all. So as long as we're talking about stars that I could see with my telescope, they're going to be relatively close and they're not going to be moving that fast. So the shifts will be very, very small fraction of an angstrom. More questions? Okay, so proper motion, all that sort of stuff. So I want to come back and talk a little bit about multiple star systems. They're going to play a relatively big role. And there's a, it turns out that there are lots of possibilities. And so I'll usually call these binaries, but there's no reason that they have to be literally two stars. It's just maybe a shorthand for it. So if we see two stars in the sky, are they really two stars that are orbiting around each other, or do they just happen to be in the same direction? So I think we've all talked about Alcor and Mizar, the Big Dipper stars. So this star here, if you look at it carefully, there are two stars, Alcor and Mizar. And it turns out that those stars, as far as we can tell, have no relationship to each other. They're at different distances. They happen to be in the same direction. So cases like this, which are fake binary systems, those things are called optical binaries, as an optical illusion. If we actually see, and I don't, for some of the groups, I did aim the telescope at Mizar. If you look in the telescope, you see two dots. And over the centuries, we have followed those two dots, and we can see that they are, in fact, orbiting around each other. So cases like that, where you see two dots, and they're clearly related to each other, and they're orbiting around each other, those are called visible binaries. So those are real cases. So we have these very similar sounding words, optical and visible, which mean kind of opposite things.
So if two stars are orbiting each other, they're probably pretty far away from each other. Otherwise they would collapse each other, right?
Like, well, they can be very close and they can be very far. So in the opening sequence of the first in time Star Wars movie, there's a sunset that has two things that are like that. That happens all the time. There's no problem with that. And we also have cases where the separation is so large, we're not sure whether they are close enough that they may have an orbit that's maybe a million years around, or whether they're separated.
Now, when they orbit each other, is it like both of them are moving?
Yeah, so it's a teeter-totter effect. So that the heavier mass star will have less motion. If we have two stars that have exactly the same motion, then the teeter-totter point will be exactly halfway between them, and they'll both be going in a circle, kind of like that. Of course, more commonly, just by chance, one is going to be more massive than the other, so it'll be going in a relatively small circle, while the other one will be going in a big circle. So it's kind of hard to draw this at all accurately, but you can imagine that I've got a star here and a star there, and as they orbit around, this guy goes in a little circle, and this guy goes in a big circle. They're both, in fact, moving. The force has to be mutual. Newton guarantees that, so there are no unmoved movers. So if one guy is moving, the other guy is moving. But if one is way more massive than the other, the so-called reflex motion will be smaller for that. So the Sun is being pushed around by Jupiter, but not nearly as much as Jupiter is being pushed around by the Sun. More questions? So there's an in-between case. You notice I left a gap between the optical binaries and the visible binaries. These are the so-called astrometric binaries. And astrometric binaries are often kind of a temporary case. So in the case of an astrometric binary, you only see one dot, but that dot is going in a circle. So it's kind of no surprise that there has to be some object there that we just haven't detected. It's not bright enough. So this was the case with the bright star Sirius. We saw that Sirius didn't have an exactly fixed position. It was moving around a little bit. It turns out that the thing that was moving it around was way smaller than Sirius. And I don't know, already this should bother you a little bit. If it's way smaller, you would guess it would be weighing a lot less, and so it wouldn't be pushing it as much. But that's not the case. Even though it's way physically smaller and way dimmer than Sirius, it actually weighs comparable to Sirius. So it's a hugely dense star. And it was pushing around Sirius, and only with a lot of work did people see this much dimmer star, the so-called pup for the dog star Sirius, that was pushing Sirius around a little bit. So astrometric binaries are cases where we just see one dot. There probably is another dot there, that we just can't see it. And usually with a lot of work you can see it. But in the meantime, it's an astrometric binary. Spectroscopic binaries. So if we're back looking, so remember Alcor and Mizar, those are optical binaries, it's a fake. If I look at just Mizar itself, in our telescope I see two dots, so that's a visible binary. If I look at the light from just one of those dots, it turns out what I see is, of course, the normal sort of spectrum that we've been talking about for stars, you know, with lots of absorption lines, except each one of these absorption lines is doubled. And what we see is absorption lines that are going like that. So when one set of absorption lines is blue shifted, the other one is red shifted, and then they come back together and superimpose, and then those same sort of lines shift the other way. So what does that mean? Well, it means that one star is moving both towards us and away from us over time, and the other star is also moving both towards us and away from us over time. And if you think about what could be causing that, is this dot must consist of two stars that are orbiting around each other. So as seen from Earth right now, this star is approaching us, and so its lines are going to be blue shifted, and this line is receding from us, so its lines are going to be red shifted. And just a quarter of a cycle later, they're moving sideways, so they're not moving towards us or away from us, so they'll have the same zero Doppler shift. And then in the future, the situation is going to be reversed. This star is going to be moving towards us, and this one is going to be moving away from us. Okay, so spectroscopic binaries, cases where we see the absorption lines are all doubled, and the lines come together and move apart, come together and move apart. And we interpret, so it must mean that part of the star is moving towards us and part of the star is moving away from us. And this is the interpretation we make on that spectra. Spectroscopic binaries. Okay, so just as before, we have two similar words that mean kind of opposites. We also have so-called spectrum binaries. We haven't talked about this in great detail, but I've flashed these slides lots of times. This is what the spectrum of the sun looks like, and these are the spectrums of various other stars. Turns out that these are the spectrum of hot stars, and these are spectra of cool stars. And you can imagine that when you take the spectra of a star, you might see what looks like the sum of those two. So for example, you might see the absorption lines of ionized helium, and that only happens at very high temperatures, and you might see the absorption lines of titanium oxide, and that only happens at very low temperatures. So how could it be that a star both has some surface that is, you know, 50,000 degrees hot and has some surface that is 3,000 degrees hot? So our interpretation of this is there are two stars there, one that is cool and one that is hot. And by happenchance, you know, for example, their orbits could be like that to you, so that they're not changing their positions in or out. By happenstance, we don't see any Doppler shift, and so it doesn't become a spectroscopic binary. So spectroscopic binary, shifting lines, spectrum binaries, we see lines from that correspond to different temperature stars. Okay, so that's my list of types of binary stars. Oh, no, I got one more type, eclipsing. So sometimes we follow the light of a star and it has a constant magnitude, but then it dips for a while, gets dimmer, and then it goes back up to a constant magnitude. And we wait a while and it comes back, and again it dips for a while and comes back to a constant magnitude. And the interpretation of that is we've got two stars that are going around each other, and sometimes the stars are eclipsed as viewed from Earth, and so it's going to be a little bit dimmer because one star is covering up the surface of the other. For most of the time we see both surfaces, and so we see a constant magnitude. So eclipsing binary stars are relatively rare, but they're kind of famous throughout history because they contradicted Aristotle's idea that everything was the same up there. So there's this star in the constellation Perseus, Algol, that noticeably dips. Yeah, with work, it's not like it goes from black to dark, but noticeably dips, and according to Aristotle, that shouldn't be the case. So the demon star of Perseus is kind of an first example of something strange going on in the sky, and it's in fact an eclipsing binary. Now I've stressed that we can get the mass of stars if we have a visible binary star whose distance we know. It turns out we can also get the mass of stars if it's a spectroscopic binary that is also eclipsing. Turns out we have enough data under those circumstances to also get the mass. So there are a couple of ways that we can get the mass of stars, but we still don't know we don't have a direct measurement of the mass of the vast majority of stars. We simply intuit it based on other sorts of data. So I want to come back to the temperature of stars. And we've said that in a theoretical sense, we can measure the temperature of stars based on the location of the peak, right? So you know, way back in the last chapter, we said that if it has a peak at short wavelengths, it's hotter than if it had a peak at longer wavelengths. But that practically speaking, that method doesn't work real well. Works pretty well for the sun, but practically speaking, it doesn't work real well with a variety of stars, basically because they start to have pretty complicated spectra, and the existence of these absorption lines kind of foos things up. So we'd like to come up with methods to get the temperature of stars that don't require a full spectrum. And the reason is that if you take a full spectrum, you've taken the light of the star and you've divided it up into, say, 1,000 different wavelength bins. So the amount of light in each one of those little wavelength bins is going to be really small. So you're not going to be able to get the full spectrum of a very dim star. So if we want to get the temperature of very dim stars, it would take too much telescope time in order to produce those sort of pictures for a dim star. So we'd like a way that would work with, that would give us the temperature of stars even for dimmer stars. And the answer, you might remember, comes from that online quiz we had, the first spectral quiz, where I kept asking you about the ratio of blue light to visible light. And there's nothing special about blue or red. I could choose any colors I want. So first of all, this is a little bit of a different idea. It's similar to the idea of a spectrum, but it's a little bit different. And that is, instead of looking for the amount of light at every individual wavelength, what I do is I put a filter on my camera so that it detects wavelengths of a relatively broad range. So I can get the total amount of light that's, say, in this range of wavelengths. And I can get the total amount of light that's in that range of wavelengths. And then I'm collecting a fair amount of wavelengths, so I'm going to be collecting a fair amount of light, so I can do this for fairly dim stars. Right? So maybe I lose 80% of the light if I just look at light that's in this wavelength range. But it's a lot better than if I look for the amount of light that's in that wavelength range, where, you know, maybe I'm looking at 1,000th the amount of light. So by looking through filters to look at a moderately sized hunk of range of wavelengths, it's going to dim the star for sure, but maybe I should comment that we're already doing that, right? Because with our eyes, we're only collecting the light that's in this range of wavelength. So we're missing all of this infrared light that, in fact, this star is producing, and we're missing this little bit of ultraviolet light, in that case, that the star is producing. So the plan is to collect light through a moderate range of wavelengths, and then take a look at the ratios of those amount of light. So there are kind of a standard set of filters that astronomers use. So there's a U filter that looks at just the ultraviolet light. There's a blue filter that looks at the blue light. There's a V filter, which is usually called visible, but it's actually kind of green. And there's a R filter that is, of course, just looking at the red light, and there's an I filter that looks at the infrared sets of light. So they're kind of a standard set of filters. We have them out at the observatory that just look at a relatively broad range of wavelengths. And then we can look at the ratio of the brightness of the star in the visible divided by the brightness of the star in the blue. Now, the first thing to recognize about ratios like this is if we have a ratio of extensive quantities, we have an intensive quantity. So if I were to take that star and push it further away, there'd be less light at blue and there'd be less light at visible, but they both might be down by, say, a factor of 2, so that the ratio of the amount of visible light to the amount of blue light, that wouldn't depend on distance. So it's an intrinsic then property of the star, one that doesn't depend on distance. So again, kind of reminding you of these pictures from spectra 1, here's a case where we have two things that are just fractions of each other. Number one is, I think, half. Yeah, this one goes up to 50, this one goes up to 100. Number one turns out is exactly half of number two, and that's exactly what you would get if you push the star out. Actually, the square root of 2 distance, right? Because the brightness falls off like 1 over r squared. But the ratio of the amount of light, of blue light to red light, would be the same for both of these spectra. Okay, and if we think about it, this should depend on temperature. So for a cool star, There's not going to be much blue light. There'll be a fair amount of red light, and there'll be even more infrared light. So we're going to have little blue. We're going to have more amount of visible, and we're going to have lots of infrared. But in any case, this ratio of visible to blue is going to be big. On the other hand, for a hot star, we're going to have more blue than visible. And that's going to lead to a small number. So this ratio of the brightness in the blue divided by the brightness in the red, it's an inverse relationship for temperature. So big numbers mean it's cool. Now, it might be worth commenting that we play exactly the same game with these filtered versions of light as we do with the normal brightness. So we can talk about the magnitude of blue light by taking the brightness through the blue filter, dividing it by the brightness of Vega through the blue filter, and calculating the so-called blue magnitude. And similarly with visible and R and I, all of them. In fact, typically that's what people do. So the magnitude of light through a filter, that's usually denoted by these same uppercase letters. So B would denote the magnitude of blue light, V would denote the magnitude of visible light, R would denote the magnitude of red light. And if you go through the math, it turns out then that if you just subtract the magnitude of the star through the blue filter from the magnitude of the star through the blue filter, that's related to minus 2.5 times the logarithm of this ratio. So if we have lots of blue light, right, think a negative number for blue, right, because lots is backwards. If we have lots of blue light and relatively little visible light, then B minus V will be negative and we'll have a hot star. On the other hand, if we have little blue light, so B is a big number, then B minus V will be a positive number and we'll have a cool star. So by looking at the relative magnitudes of light through the blue filter and the V filter, we can get a good handle on the temperature of stars. So, where is this guy? So you might have asked, you were asking me about kind of the funny scale that we had here for temperature. Look up here. So here we have B minus V for these stars is actually what is uniformly distributed. So if we know that it has a negative B minus V, then we know it's a very hot star. If it has a big number, 1, 2, for B minus V, then it has to be a cool star. And the exact formula that relates B minus V to temperature, that's something you can look up. Okay, so the main advantage of using B minus V as a way of getting the temperature of stars is that we can do it for dimmer stars, stars that are so dim that we can't do the full spectra. We're always better off doing the full spectra. We'll get a much better value for the temperature that way, but we may not be able to afford the telescope time in order to actually do that. So how about another way to get the temperature of the star without doing a whole lot of work? And the plan here is to, I don't know, it's kind of like image recognition. If we look if we look at the spectra of stars, so these are various stars, for the time being you can ignore those labels, and you can see that these look different. And so without doing a whole lot of calculations, you can learn pattern recognition to just recognize that a star that has a spectra like this has a certain temperature, and a star that has a spectra like that has a certain temperature. And there are arbitrary in-between cases too, but the whole point is we can see, you know, exactly the same things that we saw kind of numerically. So if we follow, for example, the strength of this line, the hydrogen line, we can see that it's not so strong in the hottest stars. It becomes strong and then it gets dim. So here are the absorption lines for hydrogen. These turn out to be the hot stars. It's only moderate. It gets very strong and then it gets weak, 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 weak. We can hardly see it in these cooler stars. So the metals, for example, they go to ionized states. So we're not seeing that same absorption line. Okay, so this is just a matter of pattern recognition as opposed to detailed calculation. And this is exactly what people did at the turn of the century. They made these sort of moderately crude spectra of stars, and they employed teams of women to do pattern recognition and to allot those spectra in terms of their so-called spectral type, right? Why did they use women? Because they didn't pay them much, frankly. So there weren't a lot of job opportunities for women, so Harvard hired a bevy of women to do this sort of thing. And probably the most famous is Ann Jump Compton. Who classified by herself, I think, something like 100,000 stars. So a big project that was undertaken by Harvard to make the so-called Henry Draper catalog. Circa 1900. Now, if you look at the letters that are being used, it's all kind of crazy. So this, it would be hard for me to come up with a more random set of letters than these letters, O, B, A, F, G, K, M. Incidentally, LT are new letters that are used for even dimmer stars than Harvard cataloged. Why this kind of hodgepodge? So maybe I should first get out the bad news, right? So the bad news is you got to memorize these. You got to memorize these letters in order to understand how spectral types work. So why did we make it hard for you to memorize, as opposed to say labeling the hottest stars A and the coolest stars Z or something like that? So astronomy is very much an historical discipline, and everything builds on everything else, and if you build on the wrong foundation, then the signs of that wrong foundation are going to carry through to the future. So it turns out that the first people who cataloged stars did it in kind of an obvious way. They said, the stars that have the strongest hydrogen absorption lines, I'm going to call those A stars, and the ones that are next strongest, I'm going to call B stars, and C stars, and D stars, and so it went. But that's not a good way to do it, right? Because as you remember that the strength of the line kind of falls off in two directions. So that if you classify stars according to the strength of their hydrogen absorption lines, you will put together stars that are very hot with stars that are very cool. So that's why O, which represents the hottest stars, you know, is sitting right next to M, which represents the coolest stars. So we have things in a really screwy order, basically because people did it wrong. Well, they didn't know how to do it, right? First people are often going to make mistakes. And so as figuring out this order that forces you now to memorize these things in temperature order. So, I don't know, people have invented mnemonics to try and help you remember this essentially random sequence of letters. The one that was popular when I grew up was, "Oh, be a fine girl, kiss me." And since that's, you know, sexist, these days we try and come up with other ones, but frankly, I can't remember them. Oh yeah, you can change the guy to girl just fine. So, depending upon your preferences. I think in one of these, the G is gorilla, and I can't remember them. But so I now make it a requirement for you to memorize the sequence of letters in order. So the O stars are the hot stars, the M stars are the coolest stars. The sun is kind of an intermediate star. It's a G-type star. And if we go back to this chart, that kind of relates modern classification schemes to other classification schemes, notice that we've got these sequence of letters around the top. So we don't even, O stars turn out to be pretty rare, so there aren't any O stars that are on this graph. So here we've got B stars as the hottest ones, A, F, G, K, and M. So you notice this little number that's sitting next to the letter. So the idea is that they're obviously fine intermediate cases, right? It isn't a matter of like male or female that you're either an A or a B star. There are all the intermediate possibilities between those. And those are labeled with numbers. So we have the hottest B star and the coolest O star. And we go to B9. And A0 down to A9, et cetera. So the sun turns out to be a G2 star, kind of an intermediate G star. The hottest known star is an O3 star. And since this graph was made, they've added two classes of cooler stars, which are L and T. Which we'll talk about in a while. These guys go under the name of brown dwarfs. I mean, as you can imagine, just as there isn't a definite dividing line between a planet and a dwarf planet, there isn't a definite dividing line between a star and something like Jupiter, which is also just a big bag of gas. So brown dwarfs are kind of the things that are between things like Jupiter and things like the sun. Okay, so this goes under the name spectral type. So spectral type is a letter and a number that define the type of spectrum. If the spectra looks like if the spectra has absorption lines due to ionized helium and looks kind of like this, then it's an O-class star. If it has absorption lines from titanium oxide, then it's an M-class star. So simply the type of spectra is what spectral type is. So what people discovered in making these spectral types is they discovered another distinction. So here we have a set of stars, these are the names of those stars, that have pretty much the same size of absorption line. And it turns out that size of absorption line puts them in the A classification. But sometimes that line is broad and sometimes it's narrow. So all of these stars have the same letter, but they're different. And the question is, what's the cause of the difference? And how are we going to get that into our classification scheme? So you remember that these absorption lines come from transitions, right? Cases where an electron is being knocked up by eating a photon. So we have a particle of light going in, the energy being used to raise the electron to a higher energy state. What the breadth of these lines means is that sometimes this level is a little bit higher, and that would make the line have a little bit shorter wavelength, and sometimes this line is a little bit not so high, and that would make it shift a little bit to the red. So evidently that orbit doesn't have an exactly precise value. It depends on something. And it turns out what it depends on is kind of how closely packed its neighbors are. Because the neighbors will perturb the orbits. So if we have a lot of atoms that are in close proximity, the orbits are shifted a little bit. If we have atoms that are separated enough so that they don't overlap at all, then that energy level has a very definite value. So what this is showing you is the difference between atmospheres that are dense and atmospheres that are very rarefied. Okay, so the broader lines that corresponds to a relatively dense atmospheric density, and the narrow lines correspond to stars where the atmosphere is very rarefied, almost a vacuum. Okay, and we use these Roman numerals that are called luminosity classes. So Roman numeral 1 to Roman numeral 5. In kind of older classification schemes, there was a Roman numeral 6, but I won't talk about that. So you can see Roman numeral 1s corresponds to the narrow lines. So this corresponds to very rarefied stars, stars that are almost vacuum. So these are expanded stars. Stars that have a large radius. And these things are called supergiant stars. Whereas stars in luminosity class 5, those are stars that have broad lines. And what that means is that the atmosphere is dense, So that the orbits interfere with each other. So these are relatively small stars, and these are called dwarfs. It turns out that we found even smaller stars than dwarfs. So the name dwarf is kind of not used so much anymore. And these days, these are called main sequence stars. So the sun is like this, it turns out. You may think of the sun as being pretty big, but it's small change compared to a star like Betelgeuse. So the sun is a G2 Roman numeral 5 star. And Betelgeuse, for example, it looks red, right? So it's an M-class star, and it's a supergiant star. Okay, so now let me remind you about kind of quiz stuff. So I've been making reference to the link that's in exam 3 area listed stars to know. So that's a list of stars that I want you to be able to identify their location and also their spectral type. So if you click on that link, you'll find the spectral type listed for those stars in addition to collections of those stars. So I don't know, maybe the end of next week, I know something not coming up immediately, I'll start testing you on those sorts of stars. And as I've said, since stars are kind of harder to recognize than constellations, I'll do it with lines. So I'll give you something like that, that has lines and dots in order to point out the star. So what you'll be doing is putting an arrow that points at the star and giving me its name and its spectral type. Okay, so I don't know, here's another take on exactly the same thing. So here we have a relatively broad absorption line. This corresponds to a main sequence star or a luminosity class 5 star. Here we have a very narrow line that corresponds to a supergiant star. Luminosity class 3 are called giant stars. So like luminosity class 4 are called subgiant stars. Luminosity class 2 are called bright giant stars. I can write those down, I guess. So one are supergiants. Two are bright giants. Three are just giants. I guess it's the other way, right? Four are subgiants. And five used to be called dwarfs. There's a television show that's called Red Dwarfs, and that would be luminosity class 5. These days we prefer main sequence for reasons that will be clear either today or tomorrow. I guess next week. Okay, so the best way to get detailed information about the star is to take an actual spectra where you divide the light up into thousands of little bins and you find the amount of light at all of those different wavelengths. That takes a lot of telescope time, so people try and find simpler ways of getting a handle on the temperature. The fastest way to get a measurement of the temperature is by measuring the amount of light through a blue filter and the amount of light through a so-called visible filter, and looking at the difference in magnitude, that gives you a pretty good handle on the temperature of the star. So we'll eventually talk about problems with that method. It has problems. Spectral type requires a spectra, but maybe not a detailed spectra, in order to do basically pattern recognition on the what lines are present in the spectra and which ones aren't. And we have spectral, thanks to these women and the Henry Draper catalog, we've got spectral types of literally hundreds of thousands of stars that people have looked at and done this sort of pattern recognition and written down one of these letters, OBAFGKM, to represent the class of stars. Luminosity. So, I mean, the name luminosity class, in just kind of common sense, if these guys really are giant stars, they've got more surface area that's shining. So if we're talking about stars that have the same temperature, the supergiant star is going to be way more luminous than the corresponding dwarf star. Right, so a luminosity class 1 G star, Capella for example, is going to be a whole lot more luminous than the sun is. But obviously Capella is way further away than the sun is, so it's going to be a lot dimmer than the sun. So that's the basis for this name, luminosity class. And again, it's a backward system, so that smaller Roman numerals mean brighter stars. The other way we have of dealing with luminosity is, it's kind of funny, it's called absolute magnitude. So first of all, normal magnitude, if I just say magnitude, then I'm talking brightness. And a star could be bright because it is close, or it could be bright because it's extremely luminous and far away. The idea in absolute magnitude is to take into account how distances change brightness. So what we do with absolute magnitude is we calculate how bright the star would be if it were at a particular distance from the Earth. And the particular distance that has been chosen is 10 parsecs. right? About 30 light years. So 30 light years is relatively close for a star. So mostly we're bringing these stars closer to the Earth than they actually are. And so they're going to seem to be brighter. And so the absolute magnitude is typically going to be less than even a negative number compared to its normal magnitude. Case of the sun, of course, if we were to move it to 10 parsecs, it would be a whole lot dimmer. So its absolute magnitude is going to be substantially larger than its brightness magnitude. So how exactly do we do this? Well, we know that the brightness of a star depends on its distance, and the brightness falls off like its distance divided by its luminosity divided by its distance squared. So if its brightness at some other distance, we can calculate. Its brightness at 10 parsecs, we can calculate. If we take the brightness of this star and we multiply it by the distance squared. Right, so if its actual distance is 100 parsecs, then when we move it to 10 parsecs, it's going to be a lot brighter. So if we just plug this in, we use exactly the same system as we would for normal magnitudes. So the absolute magnitude, and typically we use a capital M for this, and we use a lowercase m for the magnitude that's just based on brightness. And kind of unfortunately, that's not how we deal with the filtered ones. So if I write a capital B, I'm not talking about the absolute B magnitude, I'm talking about the apparent magnitude. If I actually wanted to talk about the absolute magnitude through a B filter, I'd write something like that, a capital M with a subscripted B. So the absolute magnitude of one of these stars is going to be minus 2.5 times the logarithm of its brightness at 10 parsecs, which is its actual brightness, and then its actual distance divided by 10 parsecs squared, all divided by the brightness of Vega. And if you know something about the magic of logarithms, you know that if I'm multiplying two things together that are inside of the logarithm, I can break them apart with a plus sign. So I can do that. If you don't understand this manipulation, that's fine. So remember that this is lowercase m, so that m minus lowercase m is a measurement of the distance to the star, and it's called the distance modulus. Okay, well, we'll call it quits there, I guess. So we'll go on next time to talk about the extremely important topic that's called the HR diagram.